Thank you very much for that introduction, David. And before I begin my lecture, and I want to first apologize for those in the audience for the double image that you see on the screen. That wasn't intentional. Since this happened, and I thank everyone who was trying to help me resolve it, but since it happened, I was thinking of an appropriate David Nichols comment to make about the double image. And for those of you who know From Dessalines to Duvalier, know Nichols' very famous comment in the preface of it, when he talks about a Haitian historian who he stayed with in Port-au-Prince while he did his research. And the Haitian historian wrote to him and said, "You forgot your lunette bicolore when you went back to England," meaning that he had seen Haiti in these two different sides. So not a perfect seg into this, but it will work for the purposes of today. I'm very, very grateful to be here and to be able to speak with you. It's a great honor for me to be presenting the 21st David Nichols Memorial Lecture. And so I thank David Howard and members of the David Nichols Trust for extending to me this honorable invitation. It's very special to me personally to be delivering this lecture because David Nichols' work meant a lot to me at a very early stage in my career, way back in the end of the last century, in the 1990s, when I started to develop a scholarly interest in Haiti. It was to Nichols' work that I turned to very early on. So it was something very, very personal to me, that journey. And more than any other work that Nichols published, and this is not just the books, but the essays, the articles, and all of the output that he really sort of shared with the world on Haiti, its past and up to the 1990s. But more than all of that, it was From Dessalines to Duvalier that had the most sort of profound impact on me. It was one of the required books for reading on Haiti for anyone serious with understanding Haitian history. And it was a starting point, I believe, for a sort of investigation of a generation of scholars that looked at Haitian history after its first appearance. And I will say this, I don't think the book has had the sustained respect it deserves. I think now as a scholar myself of Haiti, as a professor of Haitian history, I've lamented the fact that it doesn't appear as frequently as it should on reading lists on Caribbean history and Haitian history. And in some ways, that's a tribute to the vast output of scholarship on Haiti since the 1990s. And in other ways, I think that the richness and the insights that book put forward still deserve to be grappled with by students of Haiti today. In the 1970s, when much of Dessalines to Duvalier was researched and written, Nichols took readers away from the view of Haiti as a case of pathological self-destruction, a perspective that seemed to guide far too much of what was being written about the Republic. And there's a whole sort of genealogy of that sort of writing that one can find going back to the 19th century travel literature and coming down. By insisting on Haitian decolonization as part of a battle between conflicting ideas of what the Haitian state could and should be, Nichols, in many ways, stood alone. Even if his conclusions drew criticism, few could take issue with his methods and the rigor by which he set about his task. And it's not to be taken lightly, the fact that Nichols was able to look and center, really, Haitian sources at a time in which many non-Haitian writers were not privileging Haitian sources in reconstructing the Haitian past. And his many trips to Haiti and his research in private libraries, I think, really are a testament to that. It is also significant, as the late Trinidadian scholar of Haiti, Michael Dash, once remarked, that Nichols was based in Trinidad, employed at the UWI when he began to work through the ideas of the book. Trinidad was, it must be remembered, the place where C.L.R. James first avowed to write a book on the Haitian Revolution that would become his magisterial, The Black Jacobins, in 1938. There is something very important here in the way the process of Anglophone political decolonization and the discussion over independent nationalism forced a reconsideration of the Haitian model. James wrote about Haiti at the start of that process in Trinidad, and Nichols just after its completion in the 1960s. The struggles over black consciousness and governance in the former British colonies were very much alive in the decade Nichols worked on the book, and no doubt had some impact on how he viewed Haiti's past. And he makes several references to this in From Destiny to Duvalier, but more so in later works, in Haiti and Caribbean context in particular. The conclusions he drew are now classic. Race and color have been dividers of effective national independence in Haiti, but this cannot be determinative. And Nichols, in the revised edition of the book in 1996, acknowledged a difference in social and political power of color and race. In my own work on Haiti, I've argued for closer attention to the peculiar imbrications of color and race at various points in time in the Haitian past. This is, in a sense, adding nuance to the argument. But what is significant is the larger point Nichols makes about the brittleness of power in Haiti. Changes both internally and imposed from outside can reshape the material structure of Haitian power and cause further distress for Haitians. And once that process begins, the past itself becomes redefined in light of it. It is in the preface to the revised edition that Nichols, I think, best captures this point of his argument. He acknowledges that the deflation of end of Duvalier optimism after 1986, when the Duvalier dictatorship fell, and the splintering of the Duvalier's explanation of the Haitian past altered Haiti's trajectory. In his review of Haitian history from 1979, the year of the first publication of Destiny to Duvalier, to 1996, he was keen to not force his model as an explanation of the crisis after Aristide's first overthrow in 1991, but to present Haiti as a state of new tensions, connected, yes, to the past, but at the same time exploring newer measures of correction. As Nichols concluded, quote, "What are the prospects for the future? Changes in cabinet offices and speeches of self-styled presidential candidates hit the headlines, but the real life of Haiti goes on. The manifest weakness of the government has also led to an increase in crimes of robbery and violence," end quote. And this is a telling comment about the way in which you see a different sort of creation of violence. It's not the violence of the Duvalier estate and the Makuts, but a different type of violence that still was a bit too young in the mid-90s when Nichols wrote this, but it was something that was notable. The legacy of all the troubles of the Duvalierist past was effectively covered in Nichols' descriptions of contrasting murals on Port-au-Prince walls and the provocative cover of the new edition of the book From Dessalines to Duvalier. Now, if we consider the changes in the new appearance of the book, here's the 1979 edition and here's the 1996 one. The 1979 cover image is very much a story of the triumph of the Haitian Revolution, the triumph of the freed men and women who marched stoically to overcome French colonialism. This tells a very different story. It's a different history of Haiti that is highlighted there. Yes, the revolution is present in the figure of the man sat in the chair in the gingerbread house, but that person is wearing dark glasses, routine costume for the Tonton Makout, denim jeans, and carrying a sword. It seems as if this image, in many ways, is pointing to the way in which the present of the Duvalierist era has or takes or uses or even, in fact, recreates a Haitian past to serve its own ends. And in many ways, I think that captures a lot of what I see as a major contribution and lasting contribution of Nichols' work. But it is nevertheless crucial for those of us charged with the duty of revisiting that Haitian past to do, as Nichols did and encouraged, to evaluate it in terms of the present. In the one-time colony of Saint-Domingue that has come to be known by an interminable set of mostly pejorative suffixes, the poorest country in the world, poor Haiti, the magic island, the land of revolutions, there, in the middle of the western end of the universe of the Caribbean, Haitian national independence has been redefined many times over. It is the independence of Papa Dessalines that Haitians celebrate, freedom from French colonialism in 1804, emancipation from slavery, and freedom to determine its own interpretation of race and nationalism, which would be expanded across the Americas. 19th century Haitian writers spent much time interrogating this type of freedom, and David Nichols devoted a good bit of his intellectual work to show how they did so. One need only examine the works of Edmond Paul or Antonin Firmin, and compare them with their inheritors, Michel Hector, Jean Casimir, to see how constant this process of redefining Haitian freedom and race is, and the great disservice we make to Haiti when we apply conventions and interpretations from outside. Haitian self-conceptions of race have always been guided by history and moments of great change. What Haitians might refer to as noir or blanc can only be appreciated in context and chronology, as those terms do not travel unaffected through time or are not reshaped by internal conflicts. Now today, in 2023, a whole new social tension exists from the one that Nichols assessed in the 90s. The horror in Port-au-Prince, where major sectors are choking under the grip of gang violence, seems almost incomprehensible. Evacuees from the violent areas are trying with fierce desperation to find a different type of freedom, a freedom just to live. It is, to be sure, a Caribbean problem. Gangs, guns, and their trail of pain outline daily life in most islands of the Caribbean today. But in Haiti, it is most distressing because of the scale and because of the inability of political containment. Scholars of Haiti, myself included, struggle to find purchase on this situation and quite often miss the mark when asked to explain it. We cannot do so satisfactorily, I argue, because we cannot truly understand what the purpose of this violence is, what it might take to stem it, or more disturbingly, the tremendous effect it is having on Haitians today and for years to come. And indeed, what we're seeing in Haiti today with the gang violence is going to affect generations of Haitians to come. We often lean to the past for answers. We denounce foreign intervention with good reason. French colonialism brought violent slavery in the 18th century. U.S. occupation in the 20th seeded deeper internal divisions, and 21st century UN peacekeeping spread cholera and left little traces of stability. And today, a proposed Kenyan intervention has aroused considerable debate against foreign occupation or presence in Haiti. These are important insights, but they're defining a current situation of uncontrollable violence, it seems, carried out by mainly younger and younger males, where contexts of past conflicts simply do not apply. What are the prospects for the future of Haiti? Nichols asked in 1996. And it was a question that embraced the possibility of parliamentary democracy and a national effort to expunge the lingering vestiges of Duvalierism. But we are some distance now from all of that. Haiti in 2023 is not the Haiti of 30 years ago, or 20 years ago with the second Aristide coup, or even the Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. It has to be faced by a whole new set of terms, as perplexing as the prospect may be to identify them. This is not to say discussing Haiti from the perspective of its past has no value. Far from it. The past is always necessary because it holds the aspects of Haitian life and evolution essential to knowledge of the present and that journey from enslavement to freedom. And the Haitian past cannot be seen neatly as one of unbroken exploitation, as is so often the case. I wonder if there are other countries whose 220 years of national life are so glibly summarized in news reports of its present problems. That sort of approach, even by persons with great sympathy for Haiti, overlooks the remarkable history of the country and what it has given the world after 1804. What I am suggesting is that the Haitian past is best approached as being always in motion and reshaped by how we observe its present. To get to some of this nuance, the scholar must spend a great deal of time with the records of an older Haiti, and at the same time, as Nichols demonstrated in that preface to the revised edition, cast eyes closely on the responses to what is occurring presently. This is not unusual, I admit, but it is much more acute in the Haitian case because even when we probe, profess, and pronounce, we're always catching glimpses of something rather than fully seeing what it was. the massive expansion, the historiography of the Haitian Revolution, or the new exciting work being done on the 19th century, when taken together, humbly remind us just how far we have come since the period of the 1970s, when a generation of Haitianists were writing. It is my contribution this evening to that process of looking at the past and considering the present by supporting the project of re-examination of what we know about an earlier Haiti and focusing on a period of Haitian history I've spent a great deal of my career living with, the 1940s. My fascination with 1940s Haiti stemmed from how terribly misunderstood it had been. It was long treated by non-Haitian writers as a prelude to the dictatorship of Duvalier in 1957 and its extreme rule in the 1960s. Nichols was a notable departure from this tendency, seeking, as he saw it, to explain Duvalierism by closely investigating its ideological antecedents, an approach that has influenced my own. But Nichols himself, given the scale and the scope of his work and the sharp analysis of ideology and political power, did not treat as effectively or as thoroughly with the cultural tensions that lay beneath political context for power in Haiti, especially in the 1940s. And far from being marginal, the 1940s was a major moment in which Haitian notions of freedom and emancipation and liberté were redefined in popular and intellectual spaces. It was in that decade that some of the most contentious interpretations of Haitian history and the place of race in its internal and external relations were penned by writers such as Étienne Chalier, Roger d'Orsainville, and Duvalier himself, in partnership with Lorimer Denis. What is especially useful to consider is that it was a period of crisis that compelled new strategies of its generation who wished from it a different Haiti to emerge. The pivot of the 1940s, and this is something that is very much pointed out in the timeline of how we understand Haiti after U.S. occupation, was a revolutionary moment of January 1946. It was called a revolution by the people who made it, mostly initially students from the Haitian University, and then expanding from there to a core group of people, laborers, high school students, and the general population, not only in Port-au-Prince, but in provincial areas. This was different from the revolution that led to independence. It is also different from the use of the term revolution in Haiti's long 19th century, when new military leaders, eager to call themselves revolutionaries, use the word frequently to define their overthrows. And almost every moment you have an overthrow in Haiti in the 19th century straight to 1915 was always referred to in official correspondence as a revolution. Revolution in the fever of 1946 meant an end to neo-imperialism. It meant an end to dictatorship. It meant a vision of Haitian democracy. It meant a new way of seeing race, nationalism, and color. But even these aspects of the political conflict changed in the months and years following the protest of January 1946. The statement of radical youth that ignited the spark of January 46 drew on French resistance, the Spanish Civil War, and Haitian history in defining how it saw what was at stake in Haiti at that time. And here is the celebrated appearance of a text in the student paper Larouche that appeared in its New Year's edition in January 1st, 1946, which is Haitian Independence Day, in which it eagerly talks about 1946 as a year of liberty, of the triumph of true democracy. And of course, this is important coming after the war. Abattu les Franco, long live the youth, long live democracy in action, long live social justice, long live the world proletariat, long live 1804. So this is really a key moment, and it is from this that we get the ousting of President Elie Lescot, the gentleman in the center here, just 7 days after the student protest began, and you get this mass national protest against not only the Lescot government, but what many interpreted the Lescot government to sort of symbolize, which is foreign control of Haiti at that time. So 1946 is a crucial moment. The end result of much jostling, negotiating, and fighting was the election of Dumas Seyss-Estimé, a black deputy from Verrette, in August of that year. And the excitement of 1946 led its supporters to label it a dawn of a new freedom. And in fact, in the language of the time, it was seen as a new independence. The entire history of the country up to that point was portrayed quite differently by the generation of 1946. Duvalier in the mid-40s famously wrote that, quote, 1804 was an evolution. This is a revolution, end quote. In explaining the factors that led to the revolutionary moment of 1946 and all that energy that carried it, I have, in earlier work, put forth several factors that range from ideological conflicts between black nationalists and socialists to wartime radicalism that rejected perceived dictatorial tendencies of President Lescaut, as we saw in the LaRouche advert earlier. I wish, however, to give my focus this afternoon to one which has a lot of relevance to how we see Haiti today, the role of intervention. The United States had occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934. And in the years after military withdrawal, the United States continued to not only hold powerful political influence over Haitian affairs. Lescaut had been ambassador to the United States prior to becoming president in 1941, but also determined the economic direction of the country. 1946 was in the moment treated as a response to the failure of the post-occupation decade to protect Haiti from US racism, control, and economic and political interference. As one radical put it in 1946, men of 1934, you have lost. We will not lose 1946. Now, what were the specifics of US imperialism that so incensed the Haitian progressives who would eventually lead the country after Estimé's coming to power? And especially in that critical period between Estimé's coming to power in 46 and the coming to power of Duvalier in 57. What was it that was so deeply upsetting? The most determinative feature of the 1940s, insofar as foreign intervention and economic control was concerned, was the establishment of a massive project of rubber planting in Haiti. Now here you see, for those of you who were curious why rubber is in the title, here's the answer. It was under the aegis of a corporation referred to as the Société Haïtiano-Américaine pour le Développement Agricole, or more commonly known by its acronym, SHADA. The basic facts around the SHADA rubber project indicate something incredibly ambitious, not only for Haiti, but for the entire Caribbean at the time. In the war years, the Caribbean support for the Allies most typically included either service, as in the British West Indies, who joined the British Army, or in geostrategic arrangements. The Lend-Lease contracts that led to bases in Chagaramas, Trinidad, and Vernon Field in Jamaica was part of that. But SHADA was much more than this, because it involved a plan not just to extract space, people, or produce from the Caribbean, but to put in place long-term agricultural development for Haiti. The plan arose when the blockade of the Pacific made it impossible for the United States to get rubber supplies from Asia. The cutoff compelled the United States to look elsewhere for much needed rubber. Rubber for tires, rubber for boots, rubber for war material. Haiti had previously been surveyed in the early 20th century by Belgians, who determined it was highly suitable for growing Hevea and possibly Cryptostegia rubber, a vine from which a form of latex would be extracted and then produced into rubber. By the autumn of 1941, SHADA was established and developed quite rapidly. It must be stressed just how enormous this undertaking was. With a US $5 million loan from the Exim Bank, the Haitian state gave a 50-year monopoly to SHADA. 150,000 acres of pine forest and 25,000 acres were devoted for, sorry, of pine forest went to SHADA for rubber, and 25,000 acres went for sisal production for making rope. The largest effort was the land devoted for Cryptostegia, which was a total of 67,603 acres. This means, therefore, that land once occupied with sugar and coffee cultivation in the 18th and 19th century was now under the control of Shada for this massive undertaking of a new plantation agriculture. There were five regional divisions across the country, each with 10 firms. At its height, Shada had a total of 92,000 Haitian employees. To break this down a little bit further, if successful, Shada would have achieved something that Haiti had not seen since independence: mass production of favorable products such as sisal from the plantations, food crops such as spices and fruits, lumber from the pine forest, and most of all, rubber for the war effort that could then, many of the optimists hoped, generate a new export commodity for Haiti in rubber. From the vantage point of August 1941, the possibilities for Haiti to modernize was very real. Haiti could displace Malaysia in a post-war world and become a leading global supplier of latex. For Lescaut, the president who came to power in May 1941, this potential was incredibly alluring. Haiti could move leaps and bounds above its Caribbean neighbors and Latin America. Unsurprisingly, he gave Shada ringing endorsement. And this is a quote from Lescaut in the summer of 1941. "I proclaim once more the total desire of our government to put at the disposal of Shada all the land which it may need for the cultivation of the strategic produce necessary for the war effort of our great friend, the United States, even if in order to do it becomes necessary to tighten our belts and to neglect the cultivation of other produce. For us, just as for other United Nations, there can only be one task: win the war," end quote. Now, Lescaut's position here requires a little bit more explanation. The war had negative effects on economic dependent states such as Haiti. There was a crisis on the horizon that Haitian exports such as coffee would be reduced if the US, its greatest ally, went to war. Shada was a relief to a problem that seemed to be drawing closer. Support from Port-au-Prince, support from Washington, encouraged and fueled the Shada project. The president of Shada was appointed in August 1941. A man from Kentucky named Thomas Dudley Fennell was charged with the enormous responsibility of overseeing this entire operation. And now here are some images of just how extensive the Shada operations were. I think it's important to note before I proceed that what you'll be seeing from this part of the presentation through is from private archives of the Shada operations that I was given access to. And I'm working through those records now, which have actually contributed to my own revision of Haiti in the 1940s and the significance of Shada and how much effort was put into it. What is clear from my review of the documents so far is that Shada was far more significant than historians have given credit. It was unprecedented in its reach and scale and could very well have transformed Haiti's foreign exports and led the country to a different future. As I hope to make clear in the remaining time of this lecture, is that Shada's collapse 4 years after it began, 4 years after it was launched, was due not to rapacious intentions of either Lescaut or Fennell, as has often been stated, but to the contingencies of the 1940s, the backdrop that created it, to abrupt US policy changes, to antediluvian processing methods of rubber, and to the decentralization of its operations. Fennell's papers, which I've looked at, reveal that he was convinced that Shada would function with as little disruption as possible to Haitian farmers. Lescaut may have promised as much land as Shada needed, but Fennell insisted that whatever land was taken from the Haitian farmers was rented with an understanding that should the project fail, the plots would revert to the original holders. The farmers would, in turn, be employed to work on the Shada lands for pay. Fennell's position on this was no doubt influenced by his time in Haiti. Prior to the Shada project being launched, he was in Haiti since 1939, working at the agricultural school in Haiti to help develop new methods of agricultural development in core subsistence crops. Before that, he worked as a horticulturalist in Florida. In these 2 years, he had worked closely with Haitian peasants and agronomists on projects intended to increase agricultural production. This work involved a good bit of time spent with the Haitian peasantry, observing their techniques. It was Fennell who saw the Cripstogea rubber project as an opportunity to do more than plant rubble, but an effort to transform Haitian agriculture and lift the country out of its poverty. And there's a lot in this early material, both from the Haitian Department of Agriculture and from Shadow Records itself, that really point to this idea, this sort of united view that Shadow could have been an answer to Haiti's economic problem. As he put it himself, and this is taken from the first year report that Fennell filed in 1942, quote, "Haiti is one of the most economically depressed countries in Latin America. Yet Haiti is so full of opportunities, both agricultural and industrial, that the Shada management is embarrassed by its unwillingness to do more than can be properly administered and financed," end quote. Fennell oversaw the building of roads and electricity and water projects to the largest Shada areas in the Gondance Valley and Bayeux in the north. The corporation even purchased a former railroad station with the intention of reviving and expanding rail transport in Haiti, which had been largely defunct in the decade before. Fennell traveled to the United States excited by the early promise of his corporation, carrying samples of essential oils, ginger, Haitian cacao. The last he took to the Hershey Chocolate Corporation in the U.S., hoping that Haiti could become a new supply of chocolate for the United States. In a private letter from 1943, a visitor from the U.S. Agricultural Department was enthusiastic with what he found. He said, quote, "The more I see of the operation, the more convinced I am that it is, the more convinced I am that it is well conceived and executed. Nothing like it in this magnitude has ever been undertaken in tropical agriculture. If Tom," referencing Fennell, "is left alone until late fall, he will have his acreage planted. Meddling from Washington could ruin it now," end quote. This was an important admonition that came just at the apex of Cryptogeia planting. Rubber planting was introduced to Shada operations in 1942 and came to dominate the entire production line. Nowhere before had such massive planting of this kind had been done, and Fennell and his board were well aware of the risks, as much as Lescaut was hopeful of the potential. The U.S. Rubber Reserve Company and Board of Economic Warfare asked for an increase in focus on the new rubber project, and so all attention was now being directed to that. But at the same time, there were other projects for rubber development in the United States. The plant was particularly centered in Gonaïves in Haiti, and at the time in 1942 when this was being unraveled, there was no perceived end to the war. The U.S. Rubber Reserve Company was preparing for at least another 3 to 5 years for the provision of crucial rubber supplies. By the following year, 1943, Cryptogeia plantations were introduced at Cap-Haïtien and Bayeux. And by the summer, there were plantations across 6 divisions. And at the end of the year, there were a total of 45,000 Haitian laborers working on rubber planting. It was at this point of widening that the feared Washington interference that I mentioned just previously came. The Rubber Development Company had, with the effort in Haiti, also been expanding rubber supplies in the United States and elsewhere. Synthetic rubber was successful in the U.S. In 1941, the U.S. produced 231 tons of synthetic rubber. Heavy investment with petrochemical industries and university chemists and labs revolutionized production. At the same time, Fennell was putting thousands of Haitians to work on the plantations in northern Haiti. By 1944, the United States was producing over 70,000 tons of synthetic rubber. In February 1944, a delegation from Washington visited Haiti and immediately terminated the Cryptogeia contract. Fennell was directed to return all land to Haitian tenants. The shock of this was hard for all who had believed in Shada. Lescaut begged Washington to reconsider, aware of the damage it would cause to his government. His Minister of Agriculture, Maurice d'Artigue, also wrote several letters to Washington asking, please, do this in a graduated way of ending. Don't do this abruptly. Fennell took this outcome as a personal betrayal. He knew that the real reason was that U.S. rubber developers now wanted to protect U.S. rubber from overseas competition. Within months, All Crypsitsugia plantations were burned and cleared, and the land returned. Some rubber continued to be grown in Bayeux, and sisal production continued. The U.S. government gave U.S. $175,000, which works out to be roughly U.S. $2.8 million in 2023 figures, for rehabilitation of families displaced on lands that were turned over to Crypsitsugia. Embittered by the experience, Fennell resigned in September 1944 and moved to Puerto Rico for a few years and eventually returned to Florida, where he worked on a family orchid business. Just before he left, Lescaut gave him the Haitian Order of Merit for his service and efforts to improve Haitian agriculture with the Chada project. Now, public indictment against Chada came very quickly after that. Fennell was blamed for the fallout as a self-interested modern colonizer who exploited the Haitian people, then left them without anything. From Puerto Rico, just months after leaving Haiti, he wrote a statement defending his job and his work in Haiti. He said, quote, "It is obvious that they make no attempt," and they meaning his critics, "to present the facts in the case, but merely to smear my record with totally unsupported statements," end quote. The criticism of Fennell and Chada, however, greatly expanded and have echoed loudly in the historiography of Haiti. Chada and all the people who were associated with it were by 1945, on the eve of the revolutionary moment of 1946, synonymous with exploitation of Haitians. That narrative only deepened after 1946 and the election of Estime and the profound black consciousness that defined Haiti's 1940s and its cultural legacies. The student protests and even more the Estime presidency might be seen as outcomes of an anger that demand closer investigation. What might we learn from all of this? If we treat the colossal failure of Chada as one part of the drama of Haiti's 1940s, this revision of intent and outcome might be applied to other elements of how we understand the Haitian past. There is inherent in all of this a question of memory, always so vital to how we engage with Haiti, memory and history. Sometime in the late 1990s in Pétionville, Haiti, I attended a concert by Racine Voodoo group Bookman Experience. At the concert, the lead singer Lolo Beaubrun, during one of the songs, ad-libbed a list of historical moments of Haitian exploitation, starting with French colonialism. As he came closer to the present, he roared, when he reached the 1940s, "Nous songeons Chada," which translates as, "We remember Chada." The memory he recalled was a bitter collective memory born in the powerful expression of Haitian nationalism of the 1940s. As with all memories created in crisis, it carries forward emotions and it creates its own history. Haiti has had too many moments of crisis which have sprung many conflicting histories of its past. The crisis of gang violence of today is creating new explanations and rewriting old memories of the journey that brought Haiti to this distress point. But if we're to remember the forces that sought to improve and those that sought to destroy Haiti, we have to first see the Haitian past not as an unbroken cord of disaster, but loop threads, frayed but still firm. And we must equally return to the past, as Nichols insisted in the 70s with his work, with new questions from which we might get some closer understanding of what we thought we knew about the many lives of Haitian freedom. Thank you.